You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I want to welcome all our guests, and we have had the pleasure of collaborating with our friends at the Public Religion Research Institute, Robbie Jones, Dan Cox, Yuhem Navarro-Rivera. Now, this is our fourth year, but today, if I may weakly paraphrase President Kennedy, we observe today not only the unveiling of great data, but also a celebration of the fact that PRI turned five this year. This is the fifth anniversary of the founding of PRI, and this is the fifth American Values survey. And, you know, you ask in Washington, do we need another pollster? Do we need another research organization? And in fact, PRI has filled in a gap that people didn't know existed. And Robbie's done some really amazing work. And we have been very privileged here at Brookings, my colleague Bill Galston and I, to be able to work with Robbie all these years. So welcome. Because of these, I never want to forget the thank yous. And I really want to thank Darcy Cohan and Emily Fetch of PRI, who worked so hard to prepare this event, plus all the people I mentioned. Here at Brookings, I want to thank Anna Goodbaum, Christine Jacobs, Beth Stone, and Elizabeth Tom. This is the first of these events we have done without our colleague Corinne Davis, who has moved on to an awesome job, but she still realized we need her, and she sent a wonderful email wishing us good luck at this event. Corinne did a lot of work on this survey. This morning, Robbie will present the findings of the 2014 American Values Survey. And then we are really blessed by a great panel of respondents that includes Joy Reid of MSNBC, Henry Olson of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and Alan Abramowitz. Why do I forget your academic from Emory University? I just think of Alan as a protean political commentator because I read all his things and all his emails. And so just so you'll have a sense of how the event is going, I am going to introduce Robbie, who will do his patented PowerPoint presentation. And then my colleague, Bill Galston, we are co-moderating this. I promised Bill I would actually be a moderator today and not yak a lot, even though I love commenting on Robbie's data. Bill will come up and introduce the panel. They'll each speak for 10 minutes, and then we will open it up for conversation, both among ourselves and with you all. So thank you for coming. Robbie is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's a leading scholar and commentator on religion, values, and public life. He's the author of two academic books, numerous peer-reviewed articles. He has a PhD in religion from Emory University and a master, an MDiv from the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And so I invite Robbie to preach on his data.
All right. Thank you all for being here. I suppose I'll preach on the data, EJ, if you'll come down for an altar call at the end of the session. All right. Thank you everyone for being here. I am happy to say this is the fifth annual American Values Survey, PRI's annual look at religion and politics. Each year we try to pick a theme along with tracking some trends. And this year we're looking at economic insecurity and economic inequality, along with some things around the midterm elections. The other thing you'll see at the end that we're going to cover is a real dividing line among Americans about the role of the public role of religion in American life that's quite striking. We'll come to that at the end, but we'll kick it off with the economic climate, the political climate, and then come to that at the end. So first of all, I want to mention that the hashtag, if you're on Twitter, we encourage you to tweet away while you're in here today. The Twitter hashtag is AVS2014. And then just let me say one quick word of thanks to Brookings, particularly to EJ and Bill, who have been our longtime collaborators, going all the way back to the 2010 American Values Survey, which we released here at Brookings. And all along the way, we do multiple events with the religion and politics program here at Brookings and are extremely grateful for that partnership over the years. So thanks to EJ and Bill. Okay, let me jump in here. So As you can see, it's a little bit of a gloomy picture here, and you'll see why in just a minute. So first of all, what are you looking at? This is the fifth annual American Values Survey. I've done one each year since 2010, designed and conducted by Public Religion Research Institute. This is a very large survey. It's 4,500 interviews. One of the reasons why it is so large is because we're going to be doing a panel callback after the election. So we'll be calling back all the people we can get back on the phone. We'll also, just so if you've got your calendars out, be releasing that back here at Brookings on November 12th. So if you want to see what's changed between now and the election and what happens after the election, tune in and come back. We're going to be asking a number of questions to track changes and answer also some new questions as well. The margin of error for the total sample is 1.8 percentage points at the 95% confidence interval. I want to say also a thanks to generous grants from the Ford Foundation and the Nathan Cummings Foundation, which made the data collection possible. All right, so the current economic climate, it looks a little gloomy. And I'm going to start off with some data all the way back from our 2010 American Value Survey. At that time, we asked people this basic question, thinking about your current financial situation, would you say you're currently in excellent, good shape, only fair shape, or poor shape? And you'll see about half the country in 2010 said that they were either in excellent or good shape. About half said only fair or poor shape. And you'll see those numbers have dropped considerably. Now we have only about 4 in 10 Americans saying that we are in excellent or good shape compared to being in only fair or poor shape. And this is kind of one of the themes that we'll see throughout the slideshow. On a number of measures that we asked in this survey, we saw very sort of pessimistic and sort of discouragement in a lot of the numbers here. And this is despite the fact that a lot of the kind of macroeconomic indicators are good, right? So the recession is officially over. We've just received some encouraging numbers, macro numbers about the poverty level. And yet, in this survey, we still see that a significant number of Americans are still struggling economically. So here's one interesting take on this as well. We also see that there is something of some partisan lenses, especially when you ask questions about how the economy is doing, right? So when you say, how is the economy doing? Look at the partisan gaps on this question, right? So Democrats, about half of them say the economy's gotten better over the last years. Only 15% of Republicans, only 14% of those who identify with the Tea Party say the economy's gotten better over the last couple of years. Now, when I put that together with Democrats and Republicans' self-evaluations of their own situations, you can see very different things happening here, right? So Republicans, despite the fact that a majority of Republicans report being in excellent or good financial shape, only 15% of them say the economy's gotten better in the last 2 years. Among Democrats, you see a similar kind of effect. It's not quite as pronounced, but only 39% report being in excellent or good financial shape, but nearly half say that the economy is doing better. So you can really see the influence of kind of partisan lenses, even as people are thinking about the economy and their own financial shape. So one of the, contributions that this survey makes is we wanted to get certainly those kinds of self-evaluations from people, but we also wanted to get some very concrete measures about what kinds of economic hardships people were experiencing in the country. So we asked a series of questions that were very concrete. In the last 12 years, have you or someone of your household experienced any of the following 6 things, right? So reducing your meals or cut back on food to save money, not able to pay a monthly bill, putting off seeing a doctor, lost your job, had your work hours reduced, or were receiving assistance such as food stamps or unemployment benefits. And you can see the distribution of these individual questions here. The one I want to draw your attention to particularly is this top one. Right, we have more than a third of Americans in the survey saying that they have either skipped a meal or cut back on food to save money. Right, that's a pretty significant kind of hardship to experience here, and so that's a lot of Americans in that category. And then what we did is we created a composite scale based on these 6 measures, gave Americans a composite score, and this is what it looks like when you aggregate all 6 measures across. We have nearly 4 in 10 Americans who end up living in what we characterize as either high insecurity or moderate insecurity households. The way we scored these is if you were in a no-reported insecurity household, that means you literally, out of those 6 measures, reported 0 things that you had experienced. Low was 1, reported 1 experience. Moderate insecurity was 2 or 3. And the high insecurity was actually reporting that, yes, I or somebody in my household has experienced 4 or more of these things. So we have 4 in 10 Americans in these top 2 categories saying in high or moderate insecurity households. about 1 in 5 in low insecurity households and about 4 in 10 in no reported insecurity households. Now, if we take this measure and we look at it across race, we see some pretty dramatic differences here, right? So all Americans, again, about 4 in 10, Asian Americans. And one of the nice things about this survey is it's one of the few surveys, because we had 4,500 interviews, we actually have enough Asian Americans to break out in the survey, which is a pretty rare thing. So again, Asian Americans looking slightly less, about like white Americans there. And then you'll see higher levels among Hispanics. But look at African Americans here. 58% of African Americans reported being in either high or moderate insecurity households. Some very big racial and ethnic gaps here in terms of economic experiences of economic hardship. There you can see the full outscale there. The other thing we asked is a basic question. We've been asking this question for a number of years, and what we saw is kind of wavering belief in this basic concept of the American dream. And in the survey, we defined this as the idea that if you work hard, you'll get ahead. Does this still hold true? Did it once hold true, but it's not true anymore? Or did it never hold true? Among all Americans, there's a fair amount of pessimism about whether this still holds true today. Only about 4 in 10 Americans say that the American dream, that if you work hard, you'll get ahead, still applies today. About half say it once held true, but it does not anymore. And about 1 in 10, 7%, say it never held true. And again, you'll see some fairly stark differences here. White Americans look about like the national population. Notably, Hispanic Americans look about like the American population. Not a lot of differences here. But there are some fairly big differences among African Americans, right? Only 3 in 10 African Americans say it still holds true. Half say it won't hold true anymore. That's not much different. But the real difference here is 14% of African Americans say that it never held true. The American dream never held true. And then among whites, these next two categories are among whites, and we divided whites into white working class and white college educated here. And you'll see, again, a little more pessimism among white working class Americans and white college-educated Americans, the only sort of group that we have here by race and class that's in majority territory saying that the American dream still holds true today. So the political climate, that's a little bit on the economic climate. Say a little bit about the political climate. So this survey was in the field in July through mid-August. So there are definitely more up-to-date horse race numbers here, but this is the climate, and it hasn't changed significantly so much since then. So this is the generic ballot, Democratic candidate, Republican candidate in your district. This is among registered voters. And here I just wanted to kind of load out. We have basically a dead even heat among registered voters overall. But the one thing I want to kind of really draw your attention to here is the voting patterns among by religious affiliation. It turns out basically they have not shifted that much since the 2012 or even the 2010 election. They look fairly stable. And the pattern is basically this. I'm going to put three up here at once. That basically white Christians, white Catholics, white mainland Protestants, white evangelical Protestants, you know, leaning toward either majority or plurality toward the Republican candidate in their district. And then African-American Protestants, Hispanic Catholics, Jews, and the unaffiliated actually leaning quite distinctly the other way, right? So you see this basically this kind of ethnic break, particularly among Christians here, that's quite pronounced. Just to kind of drive this home, I pulled them out separately. Here is, again, among registered voters, all white non-Hispanic Christians. So 6 in 10 leaning toward the Republican candidate in their district. If I then take all non-white Christians and put it here, this kind of makes it a little more pronounced, right? Only 20% of non-white Christian registered voters leaning toward the Republican candidate, 70% leaning the other way. So this kind of tells you something about the continued kind of racial divide and that runs right through Christian registered voters in the country. Other thing I want to take is just we took the temperature of the favorability of the parties. Now, the first thing to say here is that neither party is doing very well and doesn't have overwhelmingly positive views. But there are some differences, and the Democratic Party has a slight advantage at this point in time. So here are the Republican numbers. Favorable opinion of the Republican Party, again, by race and class. One thing you'll notice is that none of these numbers cross the 50% mark. So that's sort of one notable thing. Now, let me put up the percent with a favorable opinion of the Democratic Party, and you'll see some pretty big differences. So among some more base groups of the Democratic Party, African Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanics, in majority territory. I mean, Republicans with a clear edge among whites, but you'll see that that edge among white college-educated whites is dead even, with Republicans holding a considerable edge among white working-class Americans nationwide. Do the same thing here with just some different breaks, gender and age. You'll see some similar patterns. Here are the Republican favorability numbers. You can see that not a huge divide among age here. About half of each young adults and seniors saying they have a favorable opinion. A little bit of a gender gap here, but if we put the Democrat numbers up, you'll see some stark differences. So among women, for example, 55% have a favorable view of the Democratic Party versus only 42% who have a favorable view of the Republican Party. And then the gap here among young adults, in particular, to 58 to 47, with the Democratic Party having an advantage there in terms of favorability. And then the other thing we've done in conjunction with the Brookings Institution is to take a look at the Tea Party over time. One thing we found in the report is that we've actually seen a little bit of a shrinkage of those who identify with the Tea Party over time. We had consistently found through 2010, 2011, and even into 2012, about 10 or 11% of the country said that they identified. And our question is, do you identify or consider yourself part of the Tea Party movement, is how we ask the question. We get about 10 or 11% up through 2012. And in the last year, we've seen that drop down. Our last survey has it at 7%. So some drop from 11% in 2010 down to 7%. Interestingly enough, as it's shrunk just a little bit, the composition has remained fairly stable. So we haven't seen like an exodus in one particular demographic. It's been just a kind of overall shrinkage. Demographics are fairly stable as they were in 2010. Here I've pulled out the sort of unfavorable side. I'll put the favorable side up in a minute. I thought it might be easier just to see this first. So those have an unfavorable view of the Tea Party. And what we've done here is just pick the groups that have sort of the strongest on either end of the spectrum. And I've got all Americans there in the middle. So only about 40 Americans basically divided, unfavorable view, 46% down to about 3 in 10 Republicans and conservatives. And not surprisingly, Democrats and liberals down here with about two-thirds, and also Jews, about two-thirds unfavorable view of the Tea Party. And put the favorables up on the other side. They're a little less, the spread is a little less there, but it goes up to 60, almost 6 in 10 for Republicans, a little more than half majority of conservatives, and also a slim majority of white evangelicals. But again, you can see the pattern going both ways. So very polarizing in terms of views of the Tea Party in the American public. And then finally, we'll put up this. This is one of the things we did in 2010, one of EJ's favorite charts in 2010. So I did – this is an EJ special slide right here. Did a reprise of this one. And interestingly enough, we were looking at the relationship between the Tea Party, the Republican Party, and the Christian right. We also find no change between 2010 and today in the overlap between those two groups. These numbers aren't up here, but if you look, the Tea Party is the dark red circle, right? So we're finding it now 7%. It was 11% before in 2010. But these overlaps are about the same. So if you look at just the overlap between the red circle and this more purple circle, the Christian right, what you'll see is that it takes up about half of the Tea Party circle. We find that about half, 47% of those who say they identify with the Tea Party also say they consider themselves part of the Christian conservative movement or the Christian right. That's very consistent with what we found. In fact, it's exactly the same as what we found before. And we find about 8 in 10, you'll notice that the Republican bubble takes up about 80% of the Tea Party bubble if you look at it the other way. And we find that also very consistent. 77% of those in the Tea Party also either lean toward or identify with the Republican Party. Again, about 8 in 10 is what we found in 2010 as well. So that kind of relationship also has not shifted over time. Say a little bit about some attitudes toward economic inequality and economic policies before getting to that religion break at the end here. Concerns about economic inequality. It's a basic question about equal opportunity. It's not really that bigger problem that some have more of a chance in life than others, or one of the big problems in this country is that we don't give everyone an equal chance in life. And I put this up here by those who live in sort of higher economic insecurity households versus no reported economic insecurity households. And you can see the green bars going up are the number of people who say that one of the biggest problems in this country is that we don't give everyone an equal chance in life. Right? So those who are experiencing more economic hardships feel much more strongly about that than those who report no reported insecurity actually split on this basic question. Another kind of general question here, the government should do more to address the gap between the rich and the poor. by political affiliation, big partisan divides on this question, right? So Republicans, those who consider themselves part of the Tea Party movement, less than a majority agreeing with this. Independents, 2/3, but Democrats, nearly 9 in 10, agreeing with this statement. So just in terms of like philosophy of what the government should be doing to address inequality in the country, big, big philosophical partisan divides on this question. And then we had four policies. This writing might be a little bit small for the back, but basically on the left, it's paid sick days. Next to that is policy to provide employees with paid leave for the birth or adoption of a child, so parental leave. The next one is raising the minimum wage, and the last one is increasing the tax rate on Americans earning more than $250,000 a year. You can see among all Americans, there's fairly high support for all of these policies, ranging from about 8 in 10 for the workplace policies of paid sick days and parental leave, still about 7 in 10 support for raising the minimum wage, and about 6 in 10 support for increasing the tax rate on Americans more, earning more than $250,000 a year. Democrats are, not surprisingly, perhaps on board with all of these. 7 in 10, even out here on the right, for raising the tax rate on the wealthy. About 9 in 10 on the other policies. Republicans, drop off a little bit over here, but one notable thing is like pretty bipartisan consistency on these workplace policies here. Republicans divided on the minimum wage, and then only about 4 in 10 supporting tax hikes on the wealthy. And those in the Tea Party looking fairly similar on some of the workplace policies, and even more drop-off, only 4 in 10 support for raising the minimum wage, and look about like Republicans on taxing the wealthy on the right. Now, one of the things that we see is that despite there was a fair amount of agreement on policies, we've also found that even though Americans sort of think are on board with these policies, they're fairly pessimistic about and have a sense that the deck is basically stacked against them. And you can kind of see this in these two questions. One is an agree-disagree question. The government is really run for the benefit of all the people, right? Now, there may be a snicker in the room just by the sound of that question. But 2/3 of Americans disagree with that statement. So by a margin of 2-1, disagree that the government is really run for the benefit of all the people. The other question, the economic system in this country unfairly favors the wealthy. And I flip the colors here so that they go in the same direction, but this is agreeing with the statement. But look at this is almost identical, right? So if you think about the government sort of being on the side of the common everyday person, the economic system working for the benefit of everyday person, the country 2-1 says no, that's not the case. So a fair amount of pessimism here. I want to talk just a little bit about racial inequality, and this one I think is relevant particularly to the shooting of Michael Brown this summer. And one of the things that we noticed is that we were actually in the field before, during, and after the shooting. And so that what that meant is we collected about 2/3 of our interviews before the shooting and about 1/3 of the interviews after we were in the field 5 days after the shooting. And so we picked up some effect there, and I'm going to show you just these are the numbers from 2013 to 2014. Then the next slide I'm going to isolate just our survey pre and post the Ferguson shooting. So this is the drop off overall from 2014 to 2013. Well, I guess the rise of those who disagree. So the statement we had in the survey was blacks and other minorities receive equal treatment as whites in the criminal justice system. Do you agree or disagree? This chart has the number who disagree in 2014, the number who disagreed in 2013. So you can see across a range of demographic groups, there's been an uptick in those who disagree with that statement compared to when we asked this question in 2013. You notice some big jumps among young adults in particular there, and 10-point uptick among African Americans. So that's kind of the overall picture. Let me dial in to just our survey. We broke the sample up into interviews that happened before the shooting, interviews that happened after the shooting. Here are the set of interviews that we had before the shooting. 38% of Americans, and now this is the side who agrees. So 4 in 10 agree blacks and other minorities receive equal treatment in the criminal justice system. 44% of whites agree with that statement. We put all non-whites, 29%. Only 29% agree with that statement. So you see the gap beforehand. Now here's the set of interviews that happened after the shooting from August 10th to August 15th. So among all Americans, just a little bit of a slide, but among white white non-Hispanic Americans. I should be clear, this is not a, this 4-point uptick is not statistically significant. So these numbers are basically the same here. But this downtick is significant, right? So we have a 13-point drop in African in in all non-white Americans agreeing with this statement pre and post Ferguson shooting in the sample. And one thing we I looked underneath to look and see, we didn't have enough African Americans to pull out just the African American sample there in the post-election thing. But I will say this, it's notable that we interviewed 51 African Americans after the shooting and we had zero agree with this statement after the shooting. So it's not statistically significant. It's kind of qualitative data because we don't have enough to really do a percentage, but it was absolutely zero that we had agreeing with that statement after the shooting. All right. One other thing I think for context here, we've been tracking this question a while too, that we are seeing that I think is also context for kind of racial tensions and divides in the country. This is a statement kind of capturing the idea of kind of reverse, quote unquote, reverse discrimination. Today, discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against blacks and other minorities. So this is all Americans and then divided by race and ethnicity here. You see 29% of African Americans agreeing with this, but a majority, slim majority, of white Americans agreeing with that. I should point out there's huge breaks by education here. So that it, if you look at white working class Americans, significantly more of them agree with this statement. White college-educated Americans look more like all the all-American number here. And if you look at it over here by party, you'll see big breaks by party as well. So basically a 2-to-1 difference between Democrats and Republicans on this statement. Only 32% of Democrats agree with this statement, but 6 in 10 Republicans and nearly 3/4 of the Tea Party say that discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against blacks and other minorities today. So finally, I'm going to wrap with this. Concerns about the role of public role of religion in American life. One of the things we've seen over the summer from the Hobby Lobby decision to a number of other things is the emergence of religious liberty as sort of a new front in a way in the culture wars that applies to a whole range of issues. And we asked this, we decided to try to get at least the kind of divide behind this by asking a question that was a paired opposite question that said, which worries you more? The government interfering with the ability of people to freely practice their religion or religious groups trying to pass laws that force their beliefs on others. And what we see here is that basically the public is divided right down the middle here, 46-46. So dead even split on this question. And you can see we divide it here by religious affiliation, and you can see you know, very clear sorting. White evangelical Protestants, white or Hispanic Protestants, which also tend to be evangelical, both strongly on the side of the government being worried more about the government interfering with people to freely practice religion. White mainliners, pretty evenly divided. Among white Catholics, a plurality on that side, but fairly evenly divided. African Americans, plurality on the side of worried about religious groups trying to pass laws that force their beliefs on others. And then we see kind of stronger push on the other side among Hispanic Catholics, Jews, and the unaffiliated, right, with Jews and the unaffiliated about 2/3 saying they're more worried about religious groups trying to pass laws that force their beliefs on others. So I'm aware of the time here. I'm going to wrap it up quickly and just say I think we'll come back to this probably in the conversation. So with that, let me turn it back over to EJ and Bill.
Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Galston, a senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings and a co-conspirator with EJ in our religion project and as assistants to PRRI on the creation of these surveys. Without further ado, let me introduce today's all-star panel of commentators on this report. I will introduce them in the order in which they will speak, which also happens to be the order in which they're seated here on the panel. Funny coincidence. First, Henry Olson is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where he studies and provides commentary on American politics. His work focuses on how to address, consistent with conservative principles, the electoral challenges facing modern American conservatism, and this work will culminate in a book, we all hope soon, entitled New Century, New Deal, How Conservatives Can Win Hearts, Minds, and Elections. Next is Joy Reid, who is the host of the Reid Report on MSNBC. Prior to this role, she was the managing editor of thegrio.com and the Reid Report political blog. She was also a freelance columnist for the Miami Herald for several years and produced and hosted a talk radio show called Radio One. Final commentator, Alan Abramowitz, who holds the Alban W. Barkley Distinguished Chair in Political Science at Emory. And for extra credit, those over 70 in the room get to identify Alban Barkley. Before this, he taught at the College of William and Mary and at Stony Brook University. He's the author of several books, most recently, The Polarized Public, Why is American Government So Dysfunctional? And if I may interject a personal note, I think I'm not alone in regarding Professor Abramowitz as the preeminent student of political polarization in the United States today, although there's some dissent on the left coast, I understand. First, Henry, each commentator will speak for a maximum of 10 minutes. There's a timer in front. 10 minutes is a hard stop. Over to you, Henry.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I want to start by saying, as you can tell from my intellectual interest, I am a conservative. I am a Republican. I started volunteering at a young age the week that Richard Nixon resigned. So you can't get much more hardcore than I.
Talk about buying at the bottom.
Well, 6 years later with the election of Ronald Reagan, I saw quite a capital return on my investment. But, you know, if you're sincere about your beliefs, you should not be Pollyannish about the situation in which you engage. And what I think the data show is that the American populace is worried, is at best most people are treading water. At worst, some people are falling behind. And at really worst, some people are falling into real deprivation who had not experienced that before. If you want to make an argument, that's the background in which you have to make it. Nor can you make the argument against a tide of optimism. Perhaps 5 years ago or 8 years ago, that would have been possible. But as you can see, people are slowly losing hope that the American dream, that this can be turned around. And again, for many people, it's been well over a decade since they have received significant benefits from a growing or not American economy. In an article I'm going to be publishing out soon, if you take a look at Americans who don't have college degrees and you look during the period of the growth period of the Bush administration, their incomes at best stagnated and at worst declined in real terms during the period of when the economy was growing under the Bush administration. This is the background that a lot of Americans look at, that they have not benefited even during growing times of the American economy. That's a background for the pessimism that you see in the PRRI survey. So what does it mean for a conservative? If you want to win an election, you have to put together a national majority. And if you want to win a presidential election, you have to pick up the swing states that the Democrats have been winning recently. And they pretty much come into two groups. They come into states in the Southwest, where the primary demographic challenge facing Republicans is the growth of the Hispanic community. In the same article that's coming out, if you take a look at New Mexico, or you take a look at Florida and Colorado and Nevada, Mitt Romney got the same percentage or more of the white vote than George W. Bush. The reason he lost those states is that he not only lost the Hispanic vote by more, he lost the Hispanic vote, population has dramatically increased in size. This, of course, explains why Republicans are looking at Hispanics. But the other group of states that you need to pick up if you're a Republican are in the industrial Middle West. Ohio, Wisconsin, and Iowa are three swing states. But right behind are states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Minnesota, which are only a couple of points more leaning Democrat and also have a strong indication that they could vote Republican, particularly like in Michigan, where Republicans hold a governorship and the legislature. The primary demographic in these areas is the whites without a college degree. There is very little in-migration of Hispanics. That which there is remains minor in the electorate. And there's very little in-migration of the whites with a college degree. They tend to be flocking to the coasts or certain areas in Texas or North Carolina that are more attractive. In each of these states, between 45% and 50% of the electorate are whites without a college degree. It's like you're still in 1950s America, in that you've got management in college degrees and you have workers who do not. And the Democrats do very well. According to Bron Brownstein, Barack Obama carried whites without a college degree in Ohio and in both, in Iowa and in both Ohio and in Wisconsin, he lost them by narrowly enough to offset his margin loss among whites with a college degree so that the non-white populations provided the margin of victory in both those states. So if you're a Republican trying to win those states, you have to look at the white working class. So for that in mind, I want to take a look at what this survey shows for the white working class and for what challenges that presents for the Republicans. First, the white working class is not uniform. Thanks to some documents that Robbie provided us, white evangelicals are extremely different from other white working class voters. If you ask in 2014, do you favor the Republican candidate or the Democratic candidate, white evangelicals nationwide will back the Republican. This is before you allocate leaners, 54-19. Working class Catholics, on the other hand, are roughly split. 38 for the Republican, 35 for the Democrat. If you look at how did you vote, in the Midwest, white working class split, 39-40. If you look at by religion, white evangelicals voted for Mitt Romney over 2-1, but Catholics split roughly 50-50. If you look at Ohio, Wisconsin, and Iowa, Michigan, these are places that have many fewer white evangelicals and many more white mainline Protestants, predominantly Lutherans, and many more Catholics. This is why Republicans do not win those states. Take a look at the favorabilities among white working class who are evangelicals. 33% have a favorable view of Democrats. Among Catholics, 47%. Among white mainlines, 38%. In the interest of time, I'll skip forward. So then the question is, what is it that might be wedge issues, or what is it that might be the grounds which you could bring these voters into the Republican coalition? At the abstract level, they favor lower taxes on individuals and businesses and paying for those tax cuts by cutting spending on some government programs by about a 5-4 margin. Again, it's more prevalent among white evangelicals, but even Catholics support that 51-44. White mainline Protestants actually oppose that 45-47. So the standard Republican playbook among these people has some appeal, but not an overwhelming majority appeal. Then you take a look at the issues that Robbie talked about, the parental leave, the raising of the minimum wage, and you see very strong support for all of these. Very strong support for all of these. I follow elections internationally, and I think it's notable that in the most recent Australian election, the Conservative candidate proposed to institute paid parental leave. In the most recent New Zealand election, where the National Party won re-election with nearly a majority of the vote that happened over the weekend, during its time in office, it increased the minimum wage to $14 New Zealand dollars per hour, and its priority is not cutting taxes in the next term, but improving education, increasing affordable housing for the middle class, and its pledges to increase paid parental leave from 14 weeks to 16 weeks. they are in touch with this sort of less government, but not government that doesn't work in my interest. That seems to be the dominant idea among non-evangelical working class voters. Now, why then haven't Republicans jumped on board besides the influence of the Tea Party? Although I'll note that even the Tea Party, as you can see, has large minorities, and in the case of the family leave, a majority of people who support these policies. Well, let's take a look at the difference between whites without a college degree and whites with a college degree on what their experiences are like in the American economy, because most of the decisions that get made in elections are made by elites. But it's true in both the Democrats and the Republicans. Whites without a college degree, 33% say they are in excellent or good economic shape. Whites with a college degree, 63%. Food stamp receipt, 5% of whites with a college degree have either personally or someone in their family received food stamps. 23% of the whites working class. Economic insecurity, 20-point different. American dream, 54% yes, 37% among white college, 37% yes among whites without a college degree. There's simply a gap in experience. And when you combine that with the sort of experiences people have here and combine that with philosophy, it's simply an out-of-touch leadership that doesn't see what the voters they need to talk to actually want. They tend to think that you can use religion to bring these people along, as the Republicans did in the 1980s with the Democrats, but that's no longer true. Let's take a look at the interfering with the religious freedom question. Among white evangelicals, it's working class, it's 65-28 concerned about religious liberty. Among white working class, everyone else, it's a net negative. White mainline, it's roughly 50-50. White Catholics, it's roughly 50-50. Same-sex marriage, 71% opposition from white evangelicals, 48% support from white mainline, 44% among, this is working class, among white working class Catholics, 74% among the white working class unaffiliated. Same-sex marriage does not bring your swing voter up wrong. Abortion, 54% legal in most cases among white mainline, 48% among Catholics, 67% evangelical. The Reagan Democrat no longer exists. Today's Republican conservative majority needs to take account, as successful conservatives have done elsewhere, of economic anxiety and abandon the idea that government ought to do nothing and favor the idea that Republican ought to be limited but strong in its role in trying to solve today's problems with conservative principles.
All right. Well, good afternoon. Good morning. Is it still morning? I will start off by saying, by striking a blow for bipartisanship, by saying that as a lifelong Democrat, I agree with virtually everything Henry Olson has just said.
And my career just ended.
And so did mine. I'll join you on the unemployment line afterwards. We'll be taking donations.
We're trying to end what Henry's career by inviting him here again and again.
Thanks a lot, EJ. Oh, okay. Well, thanks a lot, Henry. I'll talk about this sort of from the opposite perspective. So if you look at what we're primarily engaged in after Labor Day, where I work, is looking at electoral politics, obviously. So the upcoming midterms are very much on my mind as I'm thinking about it, and having worked a little bit in Democratic politics, I'll take sort of the other tack. If you look at presidential election years, Barack Obama holds sort of both the negative and positive record for performance of a Democrat with white voters. In 2008, he won a greater share of white voters than any Democrat since Jimmy Carter in 1976. But in 2012, he lost white voters by a catastrophic margin that had this been the election, let's say, against Ronald Reagan or against George Herbert Walker Bush, he would have lost in a landslide. Instead, he won by nearly 7 million votes. And the Obama campaign's calculation of the way they approached the election was based on, and Ron Brownstein has done a lot of this work, the election being approximately 28% non-white in 2012, it having been 26% non-white in 2008. And that approximate 2% increase in the non-white voting population every 4 years has held true, such that if Barack Obama had had the exact same sort of composition of electorate, but had been running 8 years or 12 years earlier, he would have lost. So Democrats understand that their electorate is increasingly a minority electorate added to a composition of college-educated white voters, particularly in the northern part of the country. So for midterms, that actually doesn't hold true. As we all, I'm sure, know, that non-white voting population drops off markedly in midterms, which is why you can actually, for Democrats, win a majority but still not be able to govern, because every 2 years you fall back in terms of Congress. So I want to now look at the contrast between what Henry was talking about, which is the dissatisfaction of white working class voters as contrasted with the attitudes of African-American voters. In my previous job at the GRIO, we did, before the 2012 election, an oversample of African-Americans because we were getting this narrative, this meme, even among media people, that African-Americans were increasingly dissatisfied, as white voters were, with the Obama administration, and that it would affect the reelect in a negative way. What we actually found was that African-American voters were consistently more optimistic than white voters and more optimistic than Hispanic voters about things like the economy. And I still do believe the economy is the greatest driver of electoral outcomes. If you look at the numbers in this particular survey, and you look at close to half, 46% of African Americans saying the economy has gotten better, despite the fact that, as we saw in Robbie's presentation, African Americans are doing considerably markedly worse than other populations on every scale, you wonder why that is. Looking at the employment picture again, the experience of the economy versus the facts of the economy. As of the second quarter of this year, we were at 6.1% unemployment. Historically, not very bad. For white Americans, the unemployment rate is 5.2%. So think about now the marked dissatisfaction with the economy among white voters and 5.2%. For African Americans, the unemployment rate is nearly double that. It's 11%. For Hispanics, it's, I think, 7.3%. So you have African Americans consistently more optimistic about the economy, despite the fact that they're experiencing the economy in a much more negative way, in a profoundly more negative way, just based on the data that we were presented this morning. So for a midterm electorate, what Democrats' sort of conundrum is how to get midterm electorates to look more like the general election population. And they're counting on that increased optimism, the sort of preferential attitude, and I think it is partly partisan among all of these groups, and the more positive attitude toward the economy among minority groups who they need. The kind of big irony for Democrats is that, having really lost white voters in the South, really lost them, they are now potentially going to be saved in their Senate majority by black voters who still in a plurality live in the South. So states like Georgia, states like Arkansas, Kentucky to a lesser degree, but states like North Carolina, it's very important to get black voters out. Outside the South, states like Wisconsin, very much states like Florida, going back to the South, gubernatorial and Senate races, statewide races, really are going to turn on whether Democrats can make the composition of the midterm more like the composition of 2012 and 2008, really more 2012 because we were dealing with the same economy. So getting those voters out is actually a current sort of $60 million project that is being undertaken by Democrats to take advantage of this increased optimism. I think it would be worth, we were talking in the green room earlier about how I love focus groups. I would love to see a focus group to really sit down with minority voters as to why the level of optimism is higher. I think the straightforward answer is that for African Americans, the Barack Obama administration is still a source of personal pride, and they still support the administration and will see the economy through the lens of that support. Whereas for white voters, you've seen this really marked turn against the Obama administration, even by some Democrats who might have voted for it. And that sort of general dissatisfaction with the president and with the president's party colors that attitude toward the economy. So I will, just in the interest of being brief, move it on from there. But I think it's important to look at that that racial difference. And then one more point. We've been doing a lot of reporting on Ferguson. And I was very interested in this sort of upside down view of sort of the broader questions of fairness, whether it's economic fairness or fairness in the justice system, where you have African Americans really experiencing the country as fundamentally unjust toward non-white people, and a marked increase in white Americans experiencing the country as unjust toward them. And I think part of that is the field that I work in. You increasingly have a compartmentalized media that is speaking directly to an ideological group and reinforcing whatever attitudes that group has about the economy, about the state of the economy. And the messaging, I think, is really part of the reason that you do have people experiencing the same economy, the same set of economic data in very, very different ways, and then taking those attitudes into the election. So I think if the conundrum for Republicans is how to speak to working class white voters in a way that doesn't withdraw completely the support of the government, which traditionally, going back to the New Deal, has been part of the underpinning for that economic cohort, the challenge for Democrats is taking the fundamental optimism, essentially, of minority groups and translating that into urgent voting behavior when there's no Barack Obama at the top of the ticket.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to thank the Public Religion Research Institute for inviting me to be here today. I'm delighted to be here with this very distinguished panel, and I'm going to make a few comments about, you know, the aspects of this survey that most interested me. There's an awful lot in here that's of interest, and, you know, we were sent reams and reams of crosstabs, and so I kind of honed in on a few things that really interested me. As a student of political polarization in the United States. So today's the first full day of autumn, so happy autumnal equinox to everyone. And that also means that we're now exactly 6 weeks out from the 2014 midterm election. And I don't know exactly what's going to happen in that election. I think we're pretty sure Republicans are going to keep control of the House of Representatives, maybe pick up a few seats. We don't know how the Senate's going to come out. I think it's, you know, right on the borderline between switching over to Republican control. But, you know, regardless of that, what I do think I can predict with a high degree of confidence is that the next 2 years we're going to continue to have divided party control in Washington, and that means we're going to continue to have gridlock. We're going to continue to have confrontation, and we're going to continue to have dysfunctional government. So that's the good news. And so the big question about that and what is you know, why has this been happening, and why is that likely to continue to happen after the election? I think actually that the Senate is going to be more polarized after this election if you look at the likely switches. And I think the explanation is in the data here, and that it's not just a matter of division among political elites. You can't begin to understand what's been happening in Washington and what's likely to continue going on here without understanding the fact that this divide between Democrats and Republicans that we see in Washington today and in many of our state capitals as well reflects a deep divide within the American public and in American society. And so that's the message that I see in this data. And so I want to talk there's a handout. With a few tables. Some of these points have already been covered in the PowerPoint presentation, so I'll just go over them very quickly. One is that, you know, basically what we're seeing is that Democrats and Republicans represent increasingly diverging constituencies. The kinds of voters who support the two parties are becoming more and more different. And the first table that you see there just shows the demographic divide between the two parties. Just to highlight a couple of aspects of that, everyone's, I think, pretty familiar with the differences between Democrats and Republicans just look different today. If you go to a Democratic campaign event or a Republican campaign event, you know, or you see a photograph, you know, you wouldn't be confused about, you would be able to quickly pick out which is which, right, unless you're in, like, North Dakota. I'm not sure there are Democratic rallies in North Dakota. But in most of the country, you know, the differences are stark. And the one that really stands out to me is the growing racial divide between the two parties, which is, I believe, the single most important driver of polarization in American politics. Okay, this is not a top-down phenomenon. This is a bottom-up phenomenon. American society is changing. It's becoming more racially and ethnically diverse, and that's driving the two parties apart. And the remarkable thing that we see in this data is that the Democratic Electoral Coalition today, the Democratic Party today is a majority-minority party. The Democrats are already a majority-minority party. The Republican Party remains an overwhelmingly white party. And that hasn't changed very much. And this division between the two parties is going to continue increasing. There's every reason to expect it to continue growing as American society becomes increasingly non-white. I don't see the Republican Party today. I'm sorry to give you the bad news, Henry. But I don't see the Republican Party doing anything today that's going to increase its appeal among non-white voters, among African Americans, among Hispanics. It's actually doing everything it can to drive Hispanics away from the Republican Party, as far as I can tell. So I see this divide continuing to get bigger as the country becomes more diverse. That's the big one. There are other big divides, obviously, also. That growing racial divide is in turn contributing to a growing divide in terms of policy preferences, particularly on economic issues. And you can see the data there on the second table showing the economic policy divide between the two parties, which is quite large on many of these issues, particularly on the Affordable Care Act. So Republicans overwhelmingly want the Affordable Care Act still, want the Affordable Care Act to be either repealed completely or repealed and replaced by an unspecified Republican alternative, which, of course, doesn't exist. But that's what they want, overwhelmingly. Democrats overwhelmingly are opposed to that. They want to keep it or maybe modify it somewhat, maybe actually make it more generous. That's the Democratic perspective on this. And you see that across these economic issues. What's kind of interesting is that Republican voters are actually somewhat divided on some of these economic issues, like raising the minimum wage. Democrats tend to be more unified on many of these economic issues. So there's a big economic policy divide. There's also a big cultural divide, you know, which reflects the religious divide between the two parties. But there's a divide over issues such as same-sex marriage, abortion policy, and these questions about religion and American life and whether there's, you know, the threat to religious liberty. You see a pretty big partisan divide on those questions as well. You see, particularly among whites, I should say that this cultural divide is really something that is mainly evident among whites. Certainly among African Americans, you don't see it at all. That is, you don't see a divide in terms of religiosity among African Americans. You do among Hispanics to some extent, but among whites is where you really see the big divide between those who are, you know, more devout versus those who are less devout and more secular. There's a big divide on racial attitudes. You know, we've already seen some evidence about that. The questions about, you know, do African Americans and other minorities, are they treated equally by the criminal justice system? I thought that was a factual question because the correct answer is no. I mean, there's just lots and lots of evidence that says that that's just not the case. But nevertheless, a lot of white people and even some minorities believe that that is the case. But there's a big racial divide. There's also a big partisan divide on that question. And also, you know, on the racial attitudes, I thought the reverse discrimination question was very interesting. And you have a big party divide on that question also, you know, of whether discrimination against whites is, you know, is as big a problem as discrimination against minorities. Something that hasn't been talked about yet is the media divide. There's a big divide between the parties in terms of the question was about, you know, what TV network do you consider the most trustworthy? Do you have the most trust in? Among Republicans, the leader by a wide margin is Fox News, no surprise. Among Democrats, it's divided among a whole bunch of things. Very few Democrats rate Fox News as the most trustworthy. Democrats go for the ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, public broadcasting, and interestingly, the Daily Show and Colbert is popular among Democrats. 7% of Democrats named those as their most trustworthy news source versus 2% of Republicans. But among younger people overall, it's 11%. And I didn't see it break out separately for Democrats, but I'm sure among young Democrats it's quite a bit higher than that still. So Colbert and the Daily Show are viewed as much more trustworthy among young Democrats than Fox News. So what's happening with this media divide, of course, means that, I mean, these differences in opinions across issues are getting reinforced all the time by what people are seeing on the news. I want to just touch briefly on one thing that's not in this data, because these differences, these divides on issues, and these demographic divides are also leading to a growing affective divide within the American public that's very significant, how we feel about the parties. Someone mentioned earlier, I think in the original presentation, that, you know, neither party is very popular. The main reason for that is that we hate the other party. So what we're seeing, as you look at these trends over time, is that, you know, back 40 or 50 years ago, most Americans, you know, we like our own party better than the other party. But, you know, the other party is not so great, but it's okay. Now what it is we like our own party okay. That hasn't changed very much at all. Our ratings of, you know, Democrats and Republicans rate their own parties about the same. Our ratings of the opposing party have gotten much more negative. We really dislike the opposing party. And the interesting thing to me is these attitudes are not just focused exclusively on elites. It's not just that we don't like the opposing party's leaders. We don't like the opposing party's voters. And so just to close, I would mention one thing that, you know, kind of reinforces this is a finding I just saw reported in the news about people's feelings about how would you feel if your son or daughter married. And they asked about, you know, a person of a different race. Most Americans are okay with that now. That's a huge shift in attitudes. You know, the acceptance of interracial marriage, and the actually interracial marriages are much more prevalent now. And they're accepted widely, not by everyone, but they're much more widely accepted. On the other hand, the idea of your son or daughter marrying someone from the other party, that is really unpopular. People really get upset about that. And we see that reflected in actual behavior, in dating practices and marriage. I mean, people are really partisanship is now a very strong influence. I mean, part of it has to do with, you know, similarity of values and things like that. It's not just purely about partisanship, but partisanship is highly correlated with these other things. So so this is really this party divide is deeply embedded in the American public. That's why the politicians in Washington can't get along. It's not that they don't trust each other. You know, Dana Milbank wrote this piece a few days ago about the problem is that they don't trust each other. I love Dana Milbank, but that's not right. That's not the main problem. Saying, you know, we don't trust the other party is more a symptom or an excuse. You know, Republicans say, well, we can't support immigration reform because we don't trust Obama. That's not the problem. The problem is that they really disagree about what should be done. But more importantly, they represent these different constituencies that have very diverging views. And the Republicans are afraid if they support Obama or go along with this, they'll be punished. You know, their voters will be very unhappy because they don't have to worry about Hispanic voters. They don't have any. If there are any in their district, they're not voting for them. So it's this divide within the American public and American society that's driving this divide that we see in Washington, and it ain't going away anytime soon. So on that happy note, I'll conclude.
EJ, we have 25 minutes left. I have a proposal. You put one question to the group. We'll then go to the audience. If there's time at the end, I'll put a question, and if not, not. Okay?
Oh, good. I want to hear your question, though, one way or the other. First of all, thank you, everyone, including Robbie. And I, in a way, I'd like Robbie to comment on this, but I want to sort of direct it to our respondents. First, to Henry, loyal conservative Republican, but every time I hear him, he's really a European Christian Democrat or a New Zealand conservative. And it's great to have you. And your focus on the working class, I think, is really important. I'm totally with Joy on this. And I'd love you to talk about how it's one question slightly phrased differently for each of you. For Henry, I'd like you to talk about the impact of the Tea Party on all this. It was described as populist, but its views don't strike me as solving the problem that you are describing as the problem. For Joy, and by the way, our household has been fans of yours ever since you appeared. It's on TV. It's really true. I've had this argument with people over time about the, you know, what you might call, if you're old enough, the John Lindsay coalition, minorities plus upscale people. And to me, it's immoral if the Democratic Party gives up on working class whites, because as you saw from Robbie's data, you know, working class whites have really gotten hammered and feel hammered. And I'm curious, we talked once upon a time about biracial coalitions. Jimmy Carter actually won the South with a coalition of African Americans and working class whites. How does that happen? How do you sort of get that conversation going? And the same question for Alan, given that it's the cultural divides that you identify mean that many working class whites who once were, you know, for those who stayed up late and watched the Roosevelt series, you know, the real base of the Democratic Party, something has happened, and there are differences North and South, obviously, but so I'd like you all to deal with that. But with Henry in particular, I'd love you to take the Tea Party issue on.
Yeah, I think the Tea Party, as Robbie mentioned, is primarily a mobilization of certain elements of the Republican Party. It claims to be something more, but the data have never supported that. I think insofar as they have relation to the white working class who are not already Republicans, they strike some themes that would resonate and they strike other themes that would not. They strike the theme of feeling left out and left behind that is very prevalent among white working class voters. They strike a theme that the government is working against the interest of the average person, which is another thing that is very common among white working class voters. But being from the most conservative wings of the Republican Party, they tend then also to talk about support, the problem as being government government programs and increasingly government entitlement programs. And this is something that white work, you know, this is where I think you could see a difference between an elite of the Tea Party and the base of the Tea Party, because as polls show, if you actually ask people who identify with the Tea Party, how much do you want to cut back Social Security, how much do you want to cut back Medicare, they're actually not in lockstep with their leadership. But to the extent that there is that element, it is something that is distinctly not supported by a number of white working class independents, the sort of people that you would need to win, simply because it's more important to them. That the and you can see that in part by what's going on in the Midwest right now. If you look at the nationwide right now, you know, what would you say one of the biggest Tea Party arguments is? Don't expand Medicare. Reject the Medicaid. You reject the Medicaid expansion is probably one of the most biggest things that you see. But if you're a Republican governor in one of these swing states, every single Republican governor has now endorsed Medicaid expansion. Snyder in Michigan, Kasich in Ohio, he used to be a Republican, Scott in Florida, Branstad of Iowa, Corbett of Pennsylvania, even Scott Walker, who didn't take the money, used a rejiggering of the extremely generous Wisconsin Medicaid program to increase coverage. And the Hispanics who, you know, if you ask the Republican elite, who would you love to have as a vice president? If you're not saying Marco Rubio, you're saying Susana Martinez. Susana Martinez, without a doubt, just jumped on board with Medicaid setting up a state exchange. So what are these Republican governors in these swing states that have a large number of working-class Hispanics or working-class whites doing? They're actually not following the Tea Party advice, and I think that's something that that Republicans need to look at, is the distinction between the populist and anti-government appeal of the Tea Party, which is shared by the white working class, and the anti-government rhetoric, which is not shared by the white working class, to the extent that the Tea Party has.
Interestingly enough, you cited Florida, Henry, where Rick Scott, the governor, who ran having formed a PAC to fight the Affordable Care Act, specifically his whole reason for being in politics was to fight the Affordable Care Act, a former hospital executive who left under some questionable circumstances from his former company. Scott tried to take the money and was rebuked by the legislature in Florida, which actually prevented him from taking the Medicaid expansion. And that's an interesting case because Florida, of the approximately 5 million people being locked out of the Medicaid expansion, about 1 million of them are in Florida. Florida is perhaps the most uninsured, one of the most uninsured states in the country besides Texas.
Georgia's
bad too, but I think Florida's actually worse than Georgia. But you have that imperative in those southern states to reject ideologically the idea of quote-unquote Obamacare, even at the peril of your own citizens. And in Kentucky, you have an interesting case where Mitch McConnell is trying to both run against the Affordable Care Act and run for Connect, which happens to be the Affordable Care Act. So you have this disconnect, and I think what to get to EJ's question about cross-racial coalitions, there's a reason why why so many Democrats who were successful on a national political level were from the South. And part of that is because if you go back and you look at Jimmy Carter, not when he was running for president, but when he was running for governor, part of the puzzle you have to put together as a Southern white Democrat, because it was a these were unipolar regions, the Democratic Party was absolutely the dominant party, meaning that even if your voters were voting for Ronald Reagan at the national level, at the in the state level, really until 2010, most of the Southern legislatures were still dominated by Democrats. So Democrats at the state level were still dominating actual state party politics. Even in the 94 Republican Revolution, the majority of Southern legislatures, including Kentucky, North Carolina, remained in the hands of Democrats. So threading that needle meant that you, as a Democratic politician, white Democrat in the South, you had to both balance working class white interests, especially rural voters' interests, and still keep African Americans, meaning you had to give just enough winks and nods to the racial politics that opposed Lyndon Johnson's reforms, which were seen as a perversion of the New Deal. The New Deal was seen as helping their parents, whereas the Great Society was seen as taking all of the things that were given to their parents and handing it to black people. And that experience of the Johnson programs as a betrayal of the white working class, of essentially not giving benefits like Medicare, Medicaid to all, but actually it was sort of portrayed as a theft. That was part of the Republican marketing against Lyndon Johnson. He was seen as a traitor to the South. It's part of what started the cascade away from the Democratic Party. So the only politicians who still had the skill set of both balancing rural white voters who still needed things, who still needed assistance from government, who still needed farm assistance. Remember Farm Aid in the 80s, the collapse of the family farms. This hit white rural America very hard, and they needed federal assistance. So you had this balance where you had white rural voters who still needed government, but who hated the kind of government they thought Lyndon Johnson had imposed on the South, which they saw as a second Reconstruction. Southern white Democrats knew how to have that dual conversation. It's why Bill Clinton was successful. It's why Jimmy Carter was initially successful. If you recall, in 2004, Howard Dean got in some trouble trying to articulate that by saying, we still want to have the kind of voters with a Confederate flag on their car. It was an inarticulate way of saying that Democrats need to recapture that dual conversation that Clinton really was the last Democrat who knew how to have. One of the reasons that Barack Obama did so well in 2008 in having a dual conversation both with black voters who were excited about his presidency and white voters who still had needs is because when Barack Obama was a state senator in Illinois, he spent a lot of time in downstate Illinois. He was a downstate Illinois politician who happened to live in Chicago, so he spent a lot of time cultivating downstate. Now, downstate are full of sundown towns. They're basically like the South. There's a big swath of Illinois where it's still not a good idea for African Americans to be on the streets after dark. That's very Southern in culture. But he cultivated relationships with those kind of downstate Democrats. He knows how to have that conversation. And he happens to have been raised by Midwesterners from Kansas who he grew up in that conversation. So he actually knew how to do that. So I think for Democrats, what they have to do is really what was done in Mississippi in that bizarre reelect where you had a white Republican reelected by creating a coalition of African Americans and white voters who still recognized their needs. And Democrats have to communicate that the government is capable of providing for the needs of white working class voters without, in their mind, taking something away, giving with the right hand and taking something away from the left and handing it over to minorities. Because that is the message that's been given to the white working class, and it's the reason Democrats have lost the white working class.
So just very briefly, because I largely agree with what's already been said, but I would say when you look at the white working class today, I mean, it's as has been said previously, it's a very diverse group, and it makes a lot of difference whether you're talking about Southern white working class or whether you're talking about Northern white working class. It also makes a difference if you break them down in terms of their religious orientations. They're really big differences. Overall, what I would say is that That New Deal party system, which was where the Democratic Party's coalition was really overwhelmingly based on the support of white working class voters, white Southerners, Northern white working class voters, white Catholic voters in the North. You know, that was the Democratic coalition, really, because minorities were a very, very small part of the electorate in those days. That coalition's gone, and it's not coming back. You know, those groups are very divided, and actually social class is one of the least important divisions in American politics today. For example, if you look at attitudes toward the Affordable Care Act or just about any other question measuring support for activist government today, and you control for race and say, look, among white voters, In terms of income level, there's almost no difference. Low-income whites are not more supportive of activist government than high-income whites. Low-income government whites do not support the Affordable Care Act any more than high-income whites. There's a huge party divide, regardless of income. It's all party, and that in terms it reflects a big ideological divide. People are divided over what the role of government should be, but their attitudes toward the role of government are not influenced very much at all by their social class, by their income level. And, you know, it's surprising. Even on the question of on the Affordable Care Act, I looked at some data on whether people have insurance, whether people are covered by health insurance and their support for the Affordable Care Act. It makes no difference. People without health insurance, who clearly would be the major beneficiaries of the Affordable Care Act, were no more supportive of it than people with health insurance coverage. What mattered was ideology and party. That's what determined their attitudes toward the Affordable Care Act.
Thank you.
Well, doing all of our business in an hour and a half is the verbal equivalent of trying to fit a size 11 foot into a size 7 shoe. It doesn't fit. So with your permission, and if this collides with individual schedules, please feel free to vote with your feet. With your permission, in order to allow sufficient time for questions from the floor, I'm going to tack 15 minutes onto this session. Does that produce heartburn for anybody on the panel?
It works for me.
Okay, good. It's over to you. Are there roving microphones? Okay, we have a roving microphone, and I'm going to start at the rear and move forward. So the gentleman on the aisle there.
And if you could keep your question brief so we could get everybody in, that would be really great.
Yes, let me ask you to do that and to identify yourselves and ask questions. Don't make speeches.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Larry Checo, and if somebody can clear something up for me. Realizing that there's a tremendous income gap and people vote basically for social and economic issues, it always astounds me how much people vote against their own self-interest. In other words, it always astounds me why the Republican Party gets more than 1 to 10% of the vote at all. Does that mean, given their mantra, I mean, it was expressed earlier, does that mean that people are mostly voting for religious, cultural American values when they vote Republican on the, are they voting for the social aspects of the Republican Party versus the economic aspects? Why would you vote against your own economic self-interest is my question, I guess.
Why do some people who make over $250,000 a year, quite a lot of them actually vote for the Democratic Party? You could ask that same question. They're the ones whose taxes are going to be raised. Look at San Francisco. Look at the Bay Area. All around the country. So I'm saying this, it's not so much raw economic self-interest. You know, people don't perceive it that way. When they think about which party's policies would be better for me, they're basing that on ideological grounds. The cultural issues matter somewhat, but even on the economic issues, people's opinions don't reflect their socioeconomic status very much.
I'll just throw in very briefly. When my parents came to the country, my mother almost immediately, when they immigrated in the 60s, and my mother almost immediately became a Democrat and never voted for a Republican in her entire life in this country. Voting in some senses is cultural, and we were raised culturally Democratic. My father is not an American citizen, but he is a Republican if he were an American, and he's just culturally attuned to that party. That's just the party he prefers. So I think voting to a large extent has become cultural. And if you look at the patterns even of where people live, people are actually moving to communities to be around one another because they're culturally Republican or culturally Democratic. So I think part of it is people are not parsing their economic interest as against this one guy who's running for Congress. They're saying that guy is culturally like me. I'm voting for him.
Next question, please. Yes, the gentleman on the aisle.
Hi, I'm Richard Skinner from American University. And I noticed in the graph on people's attitudes towards religion and public life, there was a really big gap between Hispanic Catholics and Hispanic evangelicals. And I've also seen a fair amount of data lately that you see sort of the two religious extremes of the Hispanic community growing, that you see more Hispanic evangelicals who tend to be more conservative and more Hispanic unaffiliated who tend to be more liberal. And I'm wondering if anybody there wants to talk about the future of cultural divides based on religion within the Hispanic community and how that's likely to affect American politics.
Robbie, please.
I can take that one. Yeah. So you're absolutely right to point to actually two transformations among in the Latino community, right? So over time, what we are seeing is a shift to being less Catholic over time. But it is going in two directions. So it's less Catholic and more Protestant. To be sure, the Protestant sector is growing, but it's also becoming more unaffiliated. And in fact, those two flows look about equal, right? And what we see is that Latino Protestants tend to be like white evangelicals. They look a lot like white evangelicals on cultural issues. They divide a little bit on the economic issues, but in terms of like same-sex marriage, abortion, they tend to be sort of culturally conservative in a way that Hispanic Catholics are not. For example, like Hispanic Catholics, 58% of Hispanic Catholics support same-sex marriage, right? So it's nearly 6 in 10 there. So it's a big divide between Hispanic Protestants and Catholics. But the short answer is that if you're just looking at ideology or political leanings, what it basically looks like is that the overall needle, if the flows are as they are today, doesn't move that much, right? Because there is equal numbers becoming unaffiliated as there are becoming Hispanic Protestant.
And if I could just say one very quick thing, and it's a red flag for Henry's party, is that the Hispanic vote today is about where the black vote was in the 1960s. It's about 65-35 overall Democratic. The precipitous move of African Americans away from the Republican Party is starting to happen with Hispanics, and it's a huge red flag for the GOP.
Mm-hmm. On the Hispanic Protestant question, I wrote a piece for that recently for National Review, and the Hispanic Protestants do share or mirror white evangelicals on their views on social issues, but they do not at all on their views on the role of government and social policy. And if you look at voting patterns, they are the most likely among Hispanics to vote for Republicans, but they still provide majority support for Democrats in most elections, unlike white evangelicals. So it is not necessarily a strong positive for the Republican Party that more Hispanics are becoming Pentecostal or other evangelical denominations, because on net, it's still a Democratic constituency.
My understanding was that white Protestants had actually moved toward the Democrats in the last election, that in some, I don't know if it was 2008 or maybe 2004, that there was a divide among Hispanics. I'm sorry. Yeah, Hispanic Protestants
In 2004, about a majority of Hispanic Protestants voted for George W. Bush, but it was still significantly less than white evangelicals. It was like 56% to 79%. And with Romney's election, it was roughly split. I think the Latino Decisions poll had Barack Obama winning a slight majority. And white evangelicals were still 79% for
I think the immigration issue is another one that unites both groups.
Yeah. And we should note that Marco Rubio only got 50% of the Hispanic vote in Florida, and he's Latino.
Okay, I'm going to take another couple of questions over here, and then I'm going to move over to the other side. Yes, please.
Kath Grossman, Religion News Service. You've been talking in terms of the midterm elections, but I want to ask you to look 10 to 15 years down the road as the demographics continue to move toward a majority-minority nation, whether and more millennials who are unaffiliated religiously are moving into the voting blocks. What does this say for the divide? Is it all just going? Is the teeter-totter going to shift even more heavily Democratic? Where are the Republicans 15 years from now?
Yeah, I mean, I've called the 2020 presidential election Armageddon for the Republican Party, because they have a twofold problem: one, that current present-day Hispanics far undervote their share of the population. They're actually more Hispanics than African Americans, but Hispanics representing 15% of the population only represent 10% of the electorate, whereas African Americans overvote or come very close to voting their population share, and it's only getting more. African Americans actually outvoted in terms of their population share white voters in 2012. For Republicans, the next big problem is that my son, I have a 14-year-old who will be able to vote in 2020. His generation is more minority than my generation, and my generation is more minority than the next generation above mine. So you have what's the youth bulge. White young voters still vote majority Republican. People assume that white younger voters are voting majority Democrat. It's still very close, but they're still net Republican, but there are less of them, and there are less and less and less of them. So as the electorate becomes more minority-laden, 2016 is going to be approximately 30% minority. Do the math. By the time you get to 2020, you're in a world of hurt if Republicans can't find a way to expand their electorate.
I can't wait for Joy's new bestseller, 6 Years to Armageddon.
Well, okay, you've got to consider that Hillary Clinton will be running for re-election.
Single white women. That's it. Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
We have two more over here, then I'm switching to the other side. So the gentleman and then the woman on the aisle.
Okay. Thanks for designating me as a gentleman, Bill. I feel elevated.
That was an effort to box you in.
I'm Wilmer Birnbaum from Georgetown University. I may say I'm the senior member of the editorial board of The Nation. We keep a list of promising future contributors and even editors, and certainly I'm going to email immediately a good reference for Mr. Olson. The marvelous Roosevelt film by Ken Burns, Roosevelt's film by Ken Burns, suffered, I think, in one respect. There was a certain underemphasis of the religious convictions underlying the behavior of that family and, of course, their associates and electorates. And the it's an interesting question to ask the panel. Do they see in the data any hint, any possibility of the kind of religious revival that would reintroduce something like the religious basis of the New Deal coalition, which had a very, very strong, if a diversified religious coalition, including at that time evangelical Protestants, labor Protestants like Niebuhr, obviously large segments of American Catholicism, and a very, very different kind of Jewish community. Is there some hint in the data somehow that this kind of thing could be revived and as a way, let's say, or as amongst one of its consequences, might be to alter the political behavior of the white Republican groupings, particularly in the middle and lower sections of the socioeconomic scale?
Thank you, Norman.
I would jump in and say I'm not sure that the New Deal coalition could be revived, but as the white evangelical Christian movement comes to grips with the fact that on most of the issues that they have fought on, they are not winning, then they either need to go away as a political group that's self-identified, or they need to have a new purpose that brings them together. And I think if you look at the data, white evangelicals tend to be significantly, if you define the question of economic life as should government be involved or not, a power question, they tend to be much more likely to be on the yes, government should be involved than the more libertarian elements of the Republican Party. They do not, in the modern, in the New Deal world, that would have meant that they would have been part of the New Deal coalition. The way the left has evolved, they remain significantly at odds with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. That gives an opportunity for a redefinition of republicanism that would be more like the New Deal, but that would be more authentically Republican and more individualistic in its implementation of a government involvement in the social safety net. But I don't think that you're going to see a recreation of the New Deal coalition because of the shift that the left has undergone in the last 80 years.
Robbie, you want to?
Just real quickly, one notable thing I think I just want to throw out here is the shrinking size of the white evangelical coalition, cohort as a percentage of the population. You know, if we break down the current population by generation and by race and ethnicity, if you look among seniors, white evangelicals make up more than 3 in 10 seniors. If you look among millennials, they make up less than 1 in 10 of millennials, right? And what we've seen also is a sort of slight shrinking so that now actually white evangelical Protestants and the unaffiliated are equal in size in the current population. About 1 in 5 Americans are religiously unaffiliated. About 1 in 5 Americans are white evangelical Protestants, and they tend to serve as kind of ballast to one another on a whole range of issues, right? They are just mirror opposites, these two groups. And I think that's a sort of new dynamic in the American religious landscape.
Robbie, yes, before, could you just, on Norman's point, talk a bit about the findings among the millennials or the under 30s? Because I think that kind of militates against the possibility of a democratic movement based more in religion.
In terms of unaffiliated?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the other thing about millennials, right, is that they are more than a third unaffiliated, right? And so while we have, you know, sort of shrinking numbers of evangelicals, they've grown, but and shrinking numbers of mainline Protestants, basically all the religious affiliation groups are shrinking in among the millennial group because the unaffiliated proportion is growing. And so I think that is a real challenge in terms of, especially if you're thinking about a sort of 1950s, 1960s, 1940s style religious coalition, the bodies just aren't there in the way that they were, you know, 50 years ago.
And if I could just say very quickly, the George W. Bush administration and Karl Rove, I think, was a big part of the planning of this. They did a very interesting thing in 2000, which was to bring mainline Protestant and evangelical groups into a relationship with government, into a financial relationship, I should say, with government, by taking a lot of government function, using this philosophical idea in conservatism that it should be your local church, it should be charity, that should be taking care of the poor, that a lot of these functions are better left to those kinds of entities, but then adding to that kind of a grant component, sort of creating a relationship. The Obama administration has co-opted that to a certain extent. They have this sort of relationship with Protestant organizations that do social policy within communities that are in a grant relationship with government. And it's an interesting twist that they've kind of co-opted from the Bush administration. It's complicated by the fact that on the Catholic side, where you do have a strong social justice component that could theoretically form the basis of what you're talking about, because within Catholicism is this strong movement toward caring for the poor, toward openness to immigration reform. It's balanced out, though, by the real dogfight between the Catholic Church and the Obama administration on contraception. So there's been a push-pull of trying to draw religious groups into a relationship with government. It always meets eventually an ideological barrier.
Which is another reason why I think it's likelier to happen on the right than on the left.
Right.
Yeah. Although there is at least, just on Joy's point, that one sentence, there's at least one study that shows that the Obama administration has actually given more money to religiously based charities than the Bush administration did. Now, a conservative would say that's because Democrats spend more money on such things, but it's a very interesting fact. Yeah. Go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry.
Good morning. Thank you all. I'm June O'Connell, a retired Foreign Service officer. And Mr. Jones had a couple slides sort of midway towards two-thirds, which had Republican and Democratic breakdown on certain issues but did not have independence. And Professor Abramowitz,
good,
sorry,
good
handout. Handout.
He is not now, nor has he ever been, Jack Abramoff.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to focus on the fact that his handout sort of said basically listed Republicans and Democrats but didn't include independence. And yet there has been a lot said in many circles that Americans are less inclined to identify with a particular party, and that that's increasingly true in terms of demographics. As the younger people get, the less they are to say that they're a Republican or a Democrat.
Right.
What about my question is really, what about the independents? Is that really mm-hmm. an illusion.
I'd like to say a word about
so,
that.
And your charts were the same.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Can I respond to that?
So
what we know is that, and the data here are broken down by Democrat, Republican, Independent. It doesn't, in what we were given, break out the independents who lean towards the Republican or Democratic Party. When you do that, however, we know from many other studies, including the 2012 American National Election Study, that independent Democrats think and behave just like Democrats. Independent Republicans think and behave just like Republicans. And there's almost no difference. So we know there's a reluctance among some segments of the American population at this point to outright say, yeah, I think of myself as a Republican or Democrat for whatever reason. It makes almost no difference in terms of behavior. In fact, the electorate today, I think there's tons of evidence that the electorate today is more partisan than it's ever been. Party loyalty in voting is greater than it has been at any time since we started studying voting behavior with survey data. Split-ticket voting is way down. People are voting a straight party ticket. All the way down from president down to state legislature. So we have a very partisan electorate that reflects these divisions in the American public, and the idea that the electorate's becoming more independent is frankly just wrong. So it's just not happening.
Yeah. And just one thing, what tends to happen is I mostly didn't include the independent number just for space. I had four bars and four questions. I already had 16 bars on the slide, so trying to save some eyeballs here. But what tends to happen is because of exactly the dynamic that Alan's describing, you have a kind of one part of the independents that lean one way, one part of the independents that lean the other way. It tends to be a wash. They look like the general population on almost all questions that we look at.
And in Robbie's defense, the report has a lot of charts that have independents in them where it was easier to present them.
And the pure independents, the independents who don't lean toward a party are usually only less than 10% of the actual voters.
6 or 7%.
And they usually split pretty evenly. And those are the folks who are the least interested in politics, the least likely to vote.
Okay, we have time for another couple of questions. I'm shifting to the other side of the room now. I see someone in the back and someone in the front. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning. My name is Emily Hardman, and I'm a student at Palm Beach Atlantic University in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm also interning at AEI right down the street from here. And I just have a question about Dr. Abramowitz. You mentioned the disparity between the Hispanic voting population and the Republican Party. And I'm just wondering if that's more of a candidate issue or a policy issue. And then if Republicans could do something maybe in legislation to try to up their Hispanic population vote. And at the same time, with the rise in Asian immigrants, I'm wondering if there's something that maybe legislation could do to help the Republican Party in that way.
Well, I think certainly if you remember, there was a report issued by the Republican Party after the 2012 election and by the Republican National Committee. And one of the main points made in that report is that the Republican Party needed to do more to appeal to minority voters in general, but Hispanic voters in particular, and specifically needed to address the issue of immigration reform. They have not done that. In fact, they've gone in the opposite direction. So that's one thing that the Republican Party would definitely need to do. I don't think nominating a Hispanic candidate or putting a few Hispanic candidates and Hispanics in leadership positions is going to make much difference. But Hispanics are concerned about issues other than immigration, and the other problem Republicans have with Hispanic voters is on economic issues. You know, as Henry pointed out, Hispanics, regardless of whether they're Protestant or Catholic, tend to be generally quite liberal when it comes to questions about the role and size of government. So I think the current trend of the Republican Party being perceived as anti-government, and particularly in response to the Tea Party movement, you know, this, I think, has actually pulled the Republican Party further away from Hispanic voters. The Tea Party movement, you know, has had its successes, but overall I think it's actually been very destructive in terms of its impact on the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, as a Republican, I would agree with most of what Alan said, which is that the Hispanic community as it currently exists is one that is largely in favor of an activist, if not a Center for American Progress, progressive view of government. It's one whose social conservatism can be overstated and the importance of which can be overstated. I don't think it's any accident that George W. Bush, who intentionally was not a libertarian conservative, is the one who's done best among Hispanic voters. With respect to Asian voters, I'd also want to point out that Asian voters have a significant working class component, too. We tend, in our classism, to think of Asian voters as all being Indian doctors or Chinese engineers, but in fact there are many more Filipino workers, there are Korean dry cleaners, there are Sikh, you know, the people who are not at the elites. And Asian Americans tend to have a very significant non-Christian component. Outside of Filipinos, who are overwhelmingly Roman Catholic because of their colonization by Spain for over 300 years, Chinese are largely non-religious because of their background. Japanese are either Buddhist or non-religious. Indians are very largely Hindu or Sikh or Muslim as opposed to Christian. And a party that is defined as the Christian Church, as is all too often the case, as for which Christianity is a requirement for admission, is one that is automatically telling Asian voters you need not apply.
Right. And just by the way, the Asian vote was even more Democratic in the last election than the Latino vote.
Yeah.
And very quickly on Hispanics, we tend to lump all Hispanic voters together, but keep in mind you're talking about a cohort that's something like 60 to 65% Mexican-American.
Right.
If you look at the seven, I believe, senators, United States senators who have been Hispanic in the entire history of the United States Senate, I think five of them are Cuban-American. Cuban-Americans are 5% of the Hispanic population.
Yeah.
You keep throwing Cuban Americans at Latinos, you're telling them you don't even get them. That's a Caribbean Hispanic versus a mainland, you know, people who are largely drawn from Mexican American background. So the only sort of national figure of a Mexican American background is Bill Richardson. He's a Democrat. So I think sometimes we make the mistake of sort of mistaking the Marco Rubios of the world for the Hispanic vote.
Right.
Cuban Americans tend to be much more conservative. And by the way, they too are trending Democratic because they're in favor of health care.
But, you know, Cuban Americans are, you know, are more Republican in their voting habits, but even they are among the most liberal of Republicans.
Right.
If you look at the Cuban Americans who represent the Miami area, who are in the Republican caucus, they almost you always end up on the liberal wing of the Republican caucus.
They're for immigration reform.
Right, because, you know, the Hispanic philosophy is not in line with the sort of Anglo-American non-activist government perspective. That's not the perspective that even Republican voting Hispanics have.
Yeah.
If you look at the voting patterns of Mexican Americans or Dominican, you know, let's take Dominicans out because
Puerto
they're
Ricans, Puerto Ricans are
Puerto Ricans are very largely Democratic, even in Florida, where they're beginning to go to. Central Americans are 7 to 8 to 1 Democratic. South Americans are 7 to 8 to 1 Democratic. The median income of a Hispanic family in America is $38,000 a year. The median Hispanic hasn't even gone to college. I mean, this is an even more working-class community generally. And for a Republican Party to think we're going to appeal to Hispanics by saying we're for immigration and then we're for tax cuts in the business class and entrepreneurship is yet again a case of disconnect, just like it is with the white working class.
Just one quick. I'll be very fast. But one thing we see over and over in our surveys is Hispanics rank three things as their top ideas, jobs in the economy, health care, and then an immigration reform. Those three things are always at the top of Hispanics' concerns. And just on the ACA question, because I think healthcare is often overlooked as something that Hispanics really care about, on whether to expand the law, keep the law, 57% of Hispanics say that we should either expand the law or keep the law as it is for the 2010 healthcare law. So,
okay. We have time for one brief question. I will allow one person to answer the brief question, and then I'm going to wrap. And if you can't ask it briefly, don't ask it at all.
Thanks. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and the question will be very brief, but I want to preface it by saying...
That's what I was afraid of.
by saying that as a season ticket holder to these series that Robbie and Bill and EJ have been doing, it's really remarkably valuable stuff and such a great panel today, and I think we really all appreciate it.
That's okay. That was
great.
Definitely.
We'll accept that.
And now to my three-part question. this is to Dr. Abramowitz. Looking at the data today makes it abundantly clear how partisan we are. What it doesn't make clear, but which you've written about considerably, is why that means we are so polarized. And the way I would frame the question is, when did we start to hate the other party?
Yeah. Hey, can we ask Robbie to close, I think, Bill? Yeah. Just let Alan talk.
And yeah, I'll be very quick on that. I mean, I think this has been a very gradual process. This is not something that happened overnight. So this group, this pulling apart of the parties, I think, is something that has been taken decades, and you know, and I think it's going to continue at least for the foreseeable future, for the next couple of election cycles at least. Is it polar? I'm sure that if Mofi Arena were here in the room, he would say everything I've just told you about could be described as sorting rather than polarization. And my answer to that is that's a distinction without a difference. That really, when people become sorted over and over again across many different issues, they're polarized. And that's what's happened, is that one of the interesting trends is that these divisions across economic and cultural issues increasingly and racial issues increasingly overlap. Not perfectly by any means, but we're seeing increasing consistency in people's attitudes across these different issues. That's certainly true at the elite level in Congress. Social conservatives are economic conservatives, and economic conservatives are social conservatives. Within the public, that's not as true, but it's increasingly true. And it's especially true among the more politically engaged and active segment of the public. When we're on the opposite sides on issue after issue after issue, then we start to really dislike each other. Because we think the other side is not just wrong, but they're actually evil. They have bad intentions.
Okay, Robbie?
So I'm going to close sort of by just bringing us back around to the thing we've talked about maybe least, but I think this is the thing that may stay with me and haunt me a little bit more than anything else in the survey, and that is the racial divides in the country. The thing that I think sticks out here is, not only do whites and blacks see things like the Ferguson shooting and very different lenses that are both partisan and racial. Whites and blacks see questions about so-called reverse discrimination, whether whites are discriminated against more than blacks. Big gaps on that question by class as well as race. We have some other questions we didn't talk about whether the government's paid too much attention to blacks and other minorities in the country. Same kinds of, just chasm divides. And I'm going to tie that together with a piece I wrote in The Atlantic as a way of closing here, that one of the things going on is from some other analysis we did, actually from last year's 2013 American Values Survey, was looking at the social networks of whites, blacks, the core social networks of whites and blacks, and we asked people to name up to 7 people that they would have close conversations about things that mattered a great deal to them. And what we found is that among whites in particular, about 9 in 10 had white social networks, they were 90% white, and 3/4 were all white. In their core social networks, that is, people they would have important conversations with. And I think that data combined with this attitude data makes me quite worried, in fact, that we're having sort of 2 very different conversations about fundamental things, about inequality, the issue of inequality, both racial and economic, in society.
Thank you. Let me close with a religious reflection, going all the way back to the New Deal question. One of the most striking little episodes in that entire series was one of Winston Churchill's visits to see FDR, where he had a feeling that he hadn't gotten through to FDR's heart. How did he deal with that? By arranging for 3 hymns to be sung, from the Anglican hymnal, at the end of which FDR remarked to one of his friends, "Yes, we are Christian soldiers, aren't we?" Can you imagine David Cameron trying to persuade Barack Obama to go along with his policies by singing hymns? The mind reels. Please join me in thanking this truly wonderful panel.